As Oshkosh progressed as a city, some of its lumber mills grew much larger in size, specializing in making doors, windows, and blinds.
They dominated the market for sash doors and blinds in the United States and in England. And nobody could compete with them because other people were not paying such low wages.
Waves of immigrants from a wide array of countries made up most of the workforce, making barely enough to support their families.
The workers in the mills worked 6 days a week, 10 hours a day.
Education of the immigrants was considered a waste of time. To give you an example, my dad went to work at the Payne Lumber Company at the age of 12. The people were so poor, they couldn't afford to take the streetcar to work. And with the wooden sidewalks, with all these thousands and thousands of men, my mother tells me there would be just a roar in the city of the men who was pounding that wooden sidewalks as they went to work. And the fact that where I grew up in the Sixth Ward, the women, generally speaking, had a kid every year if they were Catholic. The thing that saved the average working people that worked in the factories was the fact that they could raise their own crops. The lots were relatively large. I can remember this very clearly. Every square inch of that yard would be a vegetable garden. And also by law, you could have a barn on your property. You could have chickens, you could have cows. Plus, this area around Oshkosh was full of wild animals. Deers, rabbits, ducks, by the thousands upon thousands and thousands. You went out, you shot, there were no regulations about how much you could take. And the Fox River was teeming with fish. During the spring, you'd have what they call the white bass run, and there would be millions of fish. There were no regulations of the amount of fish. I can remember my dad bringing home tubs full of white bass.
Wages in Oshkosh in the early 1890s apparently had been relatively comfortable for the new immigrants who were coming to town and building houses, and they were able to function pretty well. That all began to change in 1893 when the panic of 1893 began, and the mill owners cut wages 10% as soon as the bad times started. And then they cut wages a second time and a third time. And then in the spring of 1898, the Spanish-American War came, and there was suddenly a massive inflation of food prices and rents and everything that woodworkers had to pay for. And so people who had been making a comfortable income in the years of the early 90s found themselves in dire straits.
Facing destitution, Oshkosh woodworkers turned to Thomas Kidd, General Secretary of the Amalgamated Woodworkers Union in Chicago, who helped them organize local woodworkers' unions. The workers voted to present a list of demands to the mill owners, including higher wages and recognition of the union.
The mill owners in Oshkosh got together and they rejected that. No union. So in 1898, the lumber mill workers went out on strike.
The wooden sidewalks now quiet, the mills kept running with skeleton crews of strikebreakers. And as the weeks dragged on, women relatives of the strikers got involved, organizing massive demonstrations to shut down the mills.
People like my grandma would fill their aprons with vinegar, salt, pepper, and all that stuff.
And they would embarrass the scabs, as they called them, those strike breakers. They would throw rotten eggs at the scabs. They would throw salt and pepper into their eyes at the scabs and make it as uncomfortable as possible when they came out of the factory.
Now you're talking about desperate people. They're on the verge of what they could eat, how much money they could make.
And then the next morning, they were prepared to go to the McMillan Mill, and that was when the great demonstration occurred that resulted in the death of one of the strikers. Jimmy Morrison, a friend of his, he was a painter, a 16-year-old painter at Payne, was really excited about the demonstration, and they went to the front of the line in front of all the women protesters and were hanging onto the fence. And about that time, Ed Casey, who was an engineer at McMillan, came out with the fire hose and tried to keep the demonstrators from breaking down the fence by turning the hose on them. And that infuriated the people behind him. And so that was what the surge that pushed them to push so hard against the fence that they broke the fence down. And Jimmy and his friend were propelled into the yard. And the first person that Jimmy encountered was Ed Casey, who had been holding the fire hose. But when the fence fell down, he dropped the fire hose and he picked up a stick and he hit Jimmy Morris in the head with this club. It was probably a 2x4. Jimmy Morris died that night. Thomas Kidd arranged a massive funeral, biggest funeral in Oshkosh history for him at St. Peter's Catholic Church. The whole procession walked to the Riverside Cemetery where he was buried. His grave is there, but there's no marker for Jimmy Morris.
The governor called out units of the National Guard to quell the disturbances.
They set up machine guns on a corner of 6th and Oregon Street and around the factories.
The occupation lasted for a week. When the National Guard went home, lo and behold, the strikers went back to picketing. They took a vote that they were not going to cave, they were not going to give in, they were not going to end the strike, they were going to keep up as usual.
To break the strike, George Payne, owner of the biggest sash and door plant, decided to press criminal charges against Thomas Kidd and two of the strikers.
He argued that a union and a picketer and a striker, by their very nature, are conspiracies. People get together in secret and decide to attack a corporation. And if they were accused and convicted of criminal conspiracy, if Kidd were convicted of criminal conspiracy, the danger that Kidd recognized immediately and his friend in Chicago, Clarence Darrow, recognized immediately was that this could be the end of labor unions. This could be the end of strikes. This could be the end of collective bargaining. This could be the end of picketing. And so when the attack on Thomas Kidd began, he decided that it's absolutely essential to settle this strike because the union is going to have to provide all of this legal effort for his trial.
Workers negotiated with each of the mills to end the strike, and strikers went back to work without winning a union contract.
What else you were going to do? You were stuck. You were stuck here.
In October, the trial began. Kidd had a couple of local lawyers and Clarence Darrow. He was probably the most well-versed lawyer in the country about conspiracy charges against union organizers. His questioning of hostile witnesses was ferocious. He tore the people apart who came on as witnesses against Thomas Kidd. He shredded their arguments. He's constantly building up these suspicions in the minds of his jury that he's picked so carefully about the real nature of the deceit, the real nature of the conspiracy in this case. It's not a conspiracy that Kidd organized. It was a conspiracy that George Payne organized. He was the great conspirator in the Oshkosh trial. When the jury went out in the Kidd conspiracy case, the verdict was not guilty. Unions were safe, strikes were safe, pickets were safe. And Darrow and Kidd had the feeling that it was a tremendous victory because they had saved the union movement in America.